You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Pollan is probably best known for The Omnivore's Dilemma, his best-selling investigation into how our food gets from farm to plate. In his most recent book, In Defense of Food, he focused on what to eat with this rule of thumb: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. He just won a James Beard Award for In Defense of Food, and I'm pleased that the release of the book in paperback has given us an opportunity to talk again about the way that America's food system works and how we eat. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
We've asked our listeners to write in their food rules inspired by your eat food, not too much, mostly plants. How did you come up with that rule?
Well, it was a kind of an unusual journalistic experience for me. Normally, when you start drilling down into a subject, it turns out to be more complicated than you thought, and I was learning all about nutrition and health. And this one, the deeper I went, the simpler it got. And I realized, you know, you don't have to know all this about antioxidants and carbohydrates and everything. And it really is just about eating food, which was a little alarming because I'd promised my publisher 50 or 60,000 words, and I only had seven. But it turned out that nutrition is simpler than we've been led to believe.
You recently asked readers to write in their food rules in the New York Times website. Have you been receiving a flood of suggestions?
We got 2,500 food rules from people. Great stuff. I'm still sifting through it all. The reason I'm doing that is, the end of In Defense of Food has a section of rules of thumb. You know, don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. But I realize that there is this whole cultural repository of food wisdom that we've denigrated. I mean, things we heard from our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents. And that really culture may have more to teach us about how to eat than medicine right now. So I'm trying to collect these and preserve them, whatever wisdom there is. And so I'm actually still collecting them. And if any of your listeners have one, if they would send it in, I've set up a web address, foodrules@michaelpollan.com.
And maybe they can also write into us on our comment page. I would assume that some interesting things come in from people who are recent immigrants, because they would have a very different view of how food works than people who've lived here a long time and gone through that all of those changes, post-World War II changes.
Yeah, there are. I mean, the sad thing is that they very quickly lose their food culture. Our food culture is very seductive and very glamorous. And so very often within a generation, you see the children certainly adapting to the fast food world. And the parents sometimes will hold on for a while. Certain ethnic groups, in my experience, have resisted better than others. I'm really surprised. I teach at Cal at Berkeley, and the Indian students that I teach very often are still grinding their own spices. You know, they're university students who are actually like cooking from scratch every day, and that they have a very strong taboo on adopting our food and are much healthier for it.
I was aware of this years ago when I lived in Chinatown. My landlord was Chinese and owned a restaurant, and he complained to me that his kids would prefer to go to McDonald's than to go to the restaurant.
Look, this food has been engineered to appeal to us. And they have the best food scientists in the world figuring out how to seduce us with the flavors and the smells and the sugariness and the fattiness. And so it's no surprising that this food would be attractive.
Well, can't we be seduced by food that's good for us? Why does it have to be unhealthy?
You know, it's the difference between, fast, cheap, and easy superficial pleasures and deeper pleasures. I mean, slow food is all about pleasure too, but it's a slower pleasure, and it's not as immediately appealing, although it's more lasting. I mean, I try fast food from time to time because I'm trying to understand the phenomenon. And the difference between the first bite of a chicken nugget or a Big Mac and the third or fourth or fifth bite is dramatic. It really is engineered for a satisfying an interesting first bite, and then it gets really lousy fast.
But why is it cheap? Because I've heard arguments that say, well, it depends on how you want to pay. You can either pay for well-done produce that's farmed correctly, and the prices, some people say, are a little high, mm-hmm. and they're elitist, or you can get cheap food, but it's been subsubsidized. You're paying for the carbon footprint, and you're also perhaps paying later when you have to go to the doctor.
Well, that's right. The cheap food is exorbitant when you really consider the costs. We shouldn't call it cheap food. We should call it freeloader food or something like that, because it really is. It depends on the subsidies for the corn and the soy that creates all the fast food. It depends on the fact that we're using up our antibiotics by wasting them on farm animals that I shouldn't call them farms, factory farm animals that's a huge public health expense coming. It obviously costs the environment a great deal. It contributes greenhouse gases. But at the register, it is still cheap. I mean, it's remarkable that you can buy, a very large meal for less than the cost of working at the minimum wage for 1 hour.
Well, there has been a change, hasn't there, in the last year or so, an increased interest in food as an issue. I don't know whether it's because of the change in Washington or not, but would you call what's happening around food a movement?
Oh, yeah. It is a movement. It's a very young movement, but I think it's one of the most interesting social movements in the country right now. And people don't always perceive it as such, because there's no big organization like Sierra Club or NRDC that's kind of leading the charge. And it's inchoate. And there is, you've got people working on school lunch here, people working on farm bill reform here, people working on labeling laws, like you've done a lot of great work in New York City around labeling of food, people working on community food security, dealing with these food deserts in the inner cities. But they all share some common themes. And those are basically to relocalize the food economy and move away from highly processed food to real food.
But you were quoted in the Times business section a few months back in an article called "Is a Food Revolution Now in Season?" as saying that the food movement is not ready for prime time.
Yeah, the way I see it, it's sort of where the environmental movement was pre-Earth Day, which was 1970. But we're going to get there soon. We already have the attention of the government. We have the attention of the media. And there is mounting public interest. And one of the evidences of this is, look at what the food industry is doing in response. They're actually quite nervous about what's going on, even though alternative foods of all kinds only represent 2 or 3% of the food marketplace. You see Häagen-Dazs with new 5-ingredient, they're boasting about the fact there are only 5 ingredients in their new ice cream. You see Monsanto selling sustainability as their big push. You see Frito-Lay reintroducing Lay's potato chips as local.
What does that mean?
Well, actually, precisely nothing. It's the same.
Because aren't all potatoes local somebody?
Every product is local to some place. Listen, Hostess Twinkies are local. I mean, they've got regional bakeries around the country, but it's not what was meant by local food. When I say the movement is young, it doesn't yet have expert leadership in Washington. There is not the think tank with a new farm bill ready to present the way on climate change. We had bills ready to bring to the new government. But we're getting there. And there is, and I think you will see over the next 10, 20 years a substantial food reform movement.
Do you think that the good food movement is shedding the view that it's elitist? Because as recently as a couple of months ago, we had Alice Waters on 60 Minutes being asked if she's an elitist.
And what did she say?
She said no, of course. But the feeling was that they felt she was.
I think a lot of viewers did feel that way. I don't think she said anything that I would disagree with. I might have said things in a slightly different way. But I think that image is being shed. And part of it is that the media finally is not just paying attention to Alice Waters and me, but they're also paying attention to people like Will Allen, who's doing this amazing urban agriculture work in Milwaukee. He just won a MacArthur Fellowship, bringing food to the inner city, jobs to the inner city with farming, very sophisticated polyculture farming. So the new faces of this food movement are a lot more diverse, less white, and that there is this new urban emphasis. And I think with the recession, too, that you're seeing much more interest in bringing food to people who are underserved.
My guest is Michael Pollan, whose latest book, In Defense of Food, which was a New York Times bestseller when it was in hardcover, is now available in paperback from Penguin. The last time you were on the show, we talked about your letter to the next president. We, at that moment, had not had a new president, calling for a lot of policy changes, a big one being the decentralization of the food system, which would require many more farmers to grow better food. And some people were arguing then that if we got more farmers, then we would have fewer scientists or fewer engineers, and that would affect our economic power as a society.
Well, I think that's ridiculous. I think that we could have more farmers, and I mean, people are going to give up science to become farmers.
I didn't understand it either. There are enough people out there to be scientists and farmers today too. What do we have to do to get people to go back to the farms?
We have to entice them. We have to do a few things. We have to raise the prestige of farming in our culture. We have denigrated it for 100 years. You know, the butt of jokes from like about 1900 to 1990 was always the dumb farmer. We have to, and guidance counselors on every rural high school picked out the A students, sent them to college in the cities, and left the D students on the farms. I mean, this has been the pattern for a long time. What has happened, and Alice Waters, by the way, deserves a lot of credit for this, is that we have, glamour drives our culture. And the chefs have done a wonderful job of sharing their glamour with farmers by putting their names on menus, by highlighting their work, by highlighting their ingredients. And the results of that are already clear. For the first time in the latest agricultural census, the number of farmers in America has gone up. This has never happened before. It went up by 100,000. These are small farmers servicing farmers' markets. And so that's one thing we have to do. The other thing we have to do is give them access to land. Land near the cities is too expensive. We need to be leasing them land. We need the land trust to lease them land. And we need to make it harder to develop good farmland.
And you do see farmland closer to cities in Europe than you do here.
You do.
But you said also decentralize.
Well, the other thing we need to do, I think, is use the power of government food purchases, which is immense. I mean, whether for military bases, schools, prisons, that they need to dedicate some small percentage of that spending, 2%, say, to buying within 100 miles. And that would overnight create a renaissance of local food economies.
One of the other suggestions in your letter last October was to plant a garden on the White House lawn, which Michelle Obama has now done. Do you think this is going to have a real impact? Because people didn't continue their victory gardens after World War II was over.
That's right. Well, one of the reasons they didn't is they were discouraged. The Agriculture Department got nervous that this was hurting American agriculture, and they actively discouraged people from doing victory gardens. And we began celebrating lawns to get rid of them. But I think what Michelle Obama has done is actually very significant. I mean, it's easy to dismiss it as symbolic politics, but she is not just gardening. She said and didn't need to, that this is an organic garden. Now, those are fighting words in this food fight we're in. And in fact, she heard from the industry. They were very upset. The Crop Life Association, which is the it's a euphemism for Bug Death Association, I think. They represent all the pesticide makers. They wrote her a letter saying, you know, you're casting aspersions on industrial agriculture. Won't you please use some of our crop protection products? And she was also someone recommended who has a relationship with Monsanto that she put in some genetically modified crops.
Well, you told me the last time that you were here, I'm quoting, the priorities of industry are currently being placed above those of farmers, families, and communities. Now, the president did announce last week that his administration will be taking a tougher line on antitrust legislation. How would that change the power of industry in the food world?
It's very significant, actually, because you have more concentration in the food industry than just about any other industry. I mean, most antitrust experts say that if four companies control 40 or more percent of a marketplace, it is not competitive. And in food, we have that in meat packing. There are four companies that control 85% of the beef, seed production, fertilizer production. I mean, you go down the line, there is this tight little hourglass in the food industry. Lots of farmers, very few buyers, which forces farmers to take prices. They have no control over prices at all. So if indeed we were to push an antitrust agenda in the food industry, it would be the best thing for farmers and the best thing for consumers.
Michael Pollan is my guest. He's a longtime contributor to the New York Times Magazine, also the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley, and the author of 5 books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma and The Botany of Desire, both New York Times bestsellers, as was his most recent one, which has just been released in paperback by Penguin, In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto. We will continue our conversation right after this. Back with Michael Pollan, whose latest book is In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, published now in paperback by Penguin. And people are starting to call you food writer and food activist, Michael Pollan. But your journalism career is much broader than that. Is this bothering you at all?
Well, you know, people lose track of the fact that I have written about other things. And, you know, I've always thought of myself as more of a someone who likes to write about nature. And food is part of that. It's our most important engagement with the natural world. But I've also written about drugs, which is another weird engagement we have with nature. We use these plants to change our consciousness. How strange is that? And gardening and architecture. And so I have a wide range of interests. At the moment, though, food is holding me partly because there's such a rich opportunity right now. I mean, the culture is really listening, and there's an opening for change with this administration.
We invited people to send in their rules on our comment line, and Gabrielle Longholtz of Park Slope said that the U.S. government promoted food rules during World War I that included buy it with thought, cook it with care, use less wheat and meat, buy local foods, serve just enough, use what is left.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That
Thank
was World
Gabrielle.
War I.
That's a great rule. Well, you know, in wartime, one of the interesting things that happened in both wars is the public health of the population vastly improved. We rationed meat, white flour, and white sugar. And when you get the proportion of that down in the diet, heart disease vanishes. And it did for that short period. And then we started binging on these things, partly because they had been withheld.
Well, you talked about rationing meat. A lot of listeners are writing in that we should eat less meat. But this has also been part of the American diet. I've been told by Chinese eaters that you can always tell whether the chef has been living here for a long time or just came over from China, depending on the proportion of meat to vegetable in a dish.
Yeah, and the Chinese, of course, had this wonderful vegetable-based diet. They only use meat as a flavoring, as a very small element. What you see in a Chinese restaurant in Manhattan is very different than how rural Chinese ate. And they had no chronic disease. Now, though, they are moving in our direction. And meat eating...
And we're seeing obesity in China now.
And we're seeing heart disease, type 2 diabetes. They're going through this nutrition transition, which for all people everywhere is a disaster from a health point of view. There are many, many reasons to eat less meat. Environmental, you know, high among them. People who cut out meat reduce their carbon footprint by a quarter. A lot of people aren't willing to go there, but it's important for people to understand that going partway is really important. And the whole idea of a meatless Monday, I think, is a wonderful idea.
Are the Chinese adopting the Western diet that you say is a bad idea? And if they are and that's a problem, then why aren't so many other countries in the West, like France or Italy or the Netherlands, suffering from this?
Well, they're beginning to. I mean, these great food cultures in Europe are succumbing. Gradually, the French in particular are moving towards supermarket shopping. Fast food is becoming very important, and their rates of chronic disease are going up. The Italians have held it off a little bit more. You don't see as much fast food in Italy.
And that's why slow food movement actually
and it's no,
originated
it's no accident, exactly, that slow food movement began there. So, you know, this fast food culture is very seductive, and a lot of glamour attaches to it in a place like China. One would hope that the Chinese would recognize what's happening and not go through this whole disaster. You know, we're in the middle of a feedback loop now, I think, that we've been eating this way for a generation or two, and now we're seeing the public health problems. And hopefully we will get off it and that it will seem a lot less glamorous to the rest of the world.
Now, for years, for centuries, Catholics didn't eat meat on Friday. And that was changed. I don't know if that was a bad move by the Vatican. But you're suggesting meatless Mondays?
Yeah, just for the alliteration. It could be meatless Fridays. I'd be fine with that. You know, meatless Mondays, there's a campaign coming out of the public health school at Johns Hopkins around this idea. And I think that, well, first of all, it would have a big impact. If all Americans abstain for just one day, it would be the equivalent of taking 20 million mid-sized sedans off the road. Okay? It's a big deal. And it's so doable. I mean, we all can go a day without meat. You know, it's not like we couldn't go a day without driving, those of us who live outside of a big city. We can't go a day without heating our homes. But if we went a day without meat, we would rediscover vegetables, which would be a good thing, too.
Well, food safety has become a major concern, but it has affected both vegetables and meat, although meat food safety becomes a bigger concern because more people wind up dying.
Well, the E. coli pathogens that show up in hamburger in particular are especially lethal to young children. But some of those E. coli pathogens have ended up in some vegetables. We had the spinach scandal 2 years ago.
And then more recently, the chili problem.
That's right, yeah. And look, food safety is a serious problem. We have always had food safety problems. It's not new. It's not a creation of the industrial food system, but that has made it a lot worse. You know, Aunt Mabel's potato salad has been killing people at the church supper for 100 years, I'm sure, at least. But so few people that you didn't read about it in the New York Times. But now when we're essentially washing the nation's salad in one big sink, and I know exactly where it is in the Salinas Valley at one company, 26 million portions of mixed green salad every week. When you do have a problem in one farm feeding into that salad bowl, that sink, you're going to have a huge problem.
And I've always wondered why people needed to buy their salad in a plastic bag, a cellophane bag, when lettuce comes so conveniently in leaves that you can just rip off and tear apart.
Well, you know, it's the cult of convenience. And a lot of these food safety outbreaks in produce are these bagged concoctions that, you know, have a shelf life of 18 days in a plastic bag. Is this not a good petri dish for bacteria? So, you know, I think you are better off washing your own produce, but we can't be bothered, apparently.
President Obama's Food Safety Working Group held a listening session, was it yesterday? Yesterday, to hear from individuals on changes and suggestions in our food safety policy. What would you suggest to them?
Well, I think it's another case where decentralizing the food system would be a great benefit.
So we would have to dismantle what we already have?
I think, no, we'd have to build up alternatives to it, and it would shrink. I think that if we support local agriculture, if we build Four Seasons Farmers Market, there should be a roof over the farmers market in Union Square, and so that people can be there, you know, comfortably all year long. We should encourage local meat inspections so you don't have to depend on the USDA's very limited resources to get your slaughterhouse inspected. We should improve regional distribution systems. Now, this would not cure food safety, but it would reduce the impact. You would have more resilience and redundancy in the system. After 9/11, you know, the government studied this very closely. There was a huge concern about what were the other threats that we weren't thinking about. Bioterrorism of the food system, Tommy Thompson said, was a leading threat. And the GAO did a study, and they concluded that a highly centralized food system such as we have is exquisitely vulnerable to both accidental and deliberate contamination.
So what happened?
End of story. Nobody wanted to go there. It was too threatening to the food industry, and so we just dropped it.
My guess is Michael Pollan, the follow-up to his best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, is In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto, and it's now been made available in paperback by Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In Defense of Food, you focus on problems that arise when we think too much about the science of eating. You're critical of the idea of nutritionism.
Yeah, you know, as I studied the whole problem of our national eating disorder, I realized the way we conceive of food is a big part of the problem. We think in terms of nutrients now, you know, and this is a function of science and media and government and the corporations. Because if you walk down the aisle of the supermarket, you see more biochemistry than anywhere else in your life.
All these processed foods.
All the processed foods are boasting. You know, the Cocoa Puffs are talking about, you know, about vitamin A, and they're talking about vitamin D, and they're talking about whole grain, and all the products are boasting about nutrients. But this obsession with nutrients has not made us any healthier. And nutritionism is basically the ideology of the nutrient as more important than food. And as soon as you accept that idea, What follows from that is, since nutrients are invisible, you need experts to tell you how to eat. And it becomes like a religion, right? When the visible world is not what matters, well, who's ever seen a nutrient? And so we're at the mercy of experts who, it turns out, know a lot less than they think they do.
We had Tara Parker Pope of the New York mm-hmm. Times here not long ago, and she talked about whether vitamin pills are necessary. This is, I think, part of the same nutritionism thing. She said that if you eat well and you eat good food, the foods have their own nutrients and also have things that help those nutrients give you all the things that you need. And people were outraged because I think that – and these are people who probably would agree with you and be your readers because they feel that vitamin pills are really important. And they, we got all sorts of comments suggesting that she was in pay of the pharmaceuticals, which, of course, make many of those vitamin pills themselves. But there's
– How is she in the pay of the pharmaceuticals if she was telling people vitamins didn't work?
Well, she's not saying vitamins don't work. She's saying vitamin pills – are not the best way to get.
Yeah, well, she's absolutely right about that. There have been a lot of studies of supplements that have come out in the last year or so, and one after another, they show that supplements don't work. The mystery is, the confounding mystery is that people who take supplements are healthier than other people, but you have to look at why. If you take supplements, you're probably a health conscious person. If you're a health conscious person, you're probably exercising and eating whole grain. You're also probably fairly well-to-do, because supplements are expensive, fairly well-educated, and therefore you are a healthier person. But it has nothing to do with the supplements you're taking. So we do waste a lot of money on supplements, and we don't understand when you take a nutrient out of the context of a food, it often doesn't behave as it does in the food. I think that's what she was referring to. There are these synergies in foods that we do not understand. Whole grain is a great example. There's a fascinating study a couple years ago that, you know, whole grain has got folic acid, other B vitamins, it's got fiber, it's got omega-3s, it's all this stuff. If you control for levels of all those things, the benefit is still not as good as the actual whole grain. There is some X factor, and it may be a synergy or it may be a nutrient we haven't identified yet. But if you eat whole grains, you get benefits that you don't get from any of the constituents of whole grains.
So nature is giving us all we need if we just do it right and we don't process it.
Exactly. And we shouldn't be surprised that this is no accident. We evolved to make very good use of what nature gives us. We have not yet evolved to make good use of what food science gives us.
Well, you have cited supermarkets as a major problem. Is it supermarkets or what we go to supermarkets for?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, the supermarkets are largely, you know, their shelf space is sold to the food manufacturers. The supermarket doesn't decide what's going to be on the shelf. They bid it out to General Mills or whoever it is. So they're like common carriers. I mean, you know, they'll sell anything.
Marion Nestle says the best way to go to a supermarket is to only walk on the outside.
The periphery. That's where the food that has been less fiddled with over the last 75 years will be found. And the imperishable stuff in the middle, that's what you should stay away from.
LaDonna Redmond, the food activist from Chicago, points out that we've never had a fair food system because it was built on the backs of slaves and now illegal or underpaid workers, and because our government subsidizes fast food that makes up most of what's available to eat in poor neighborhoods. How do we as a nation balance the need to pay farmers and workers fairly with the need for low-income people to have access to better food?
Well, that is the big question. I mean, that frames it very succinctly. Look, our farmers are very good at what they do. They are right now responding to the incentives we have given them with our farm subsidy system. And those incentives are to maximize production of a handful of commodity crops, corn, soy, wheat, rice, cotton, grown in monocultures. And that, by the way, was in the public interest once. If you go back 75 or 100 years, the big public health problem was not enough calories. There were hungry people. And we asked them to overproduce, to provide this, to solve this problem. But the problem is different. They've done too good a job. They're producing too much food. So we now need to change the incentives to get them to once again line up with what we need. And that is to grow real food, to sequester carbon, to diversify their farms. And I know they can do it. They're really good.
You've also pointed out that local food is more resilient to shocks like poor harvests or safety issues.
Oil price spikes, too.
So why does the agribusiness lobby insist that local food can't provide the sheer amount that we need?
Well, because this national system is incredibly profitable. Look, the way you make money in food is not growing it. The way you make money in food is buying cheap agricultural commodities, corn, soy, wheat, rice, and cotton, and processing it so that pennies of that, you know. Here's a good example. Oatmeal. Okay, I can buy steel-cut oatmeal, organic, for about 79 cents a pound. It's a lot of oatmeal. But it's very hard to make money selling that oatmeal. You turn it into Cheerios, right? That first step of processing, suddenly you're getting $4 for a few ounces of oats, okay? And you have intellectual property you can protect, the name Cheerios. Then that becomes a commodity, and Costco or everybody has their own brand of Cheerios. So what does the General Mills do then, or whoever makes Cheerios? You make Honey Nut Cheerios cereal bars with synthetic milk. Mm-hmm. And then now what are you charging for those oats? So the money, the more you process the food, the more profitable it is. The only problem with this is the more you process the food, the less nutritious it is. You're much better off with those steel-cut oats.
What about those nutrition bars? Are they nutritious?
They're a joke. No. It's processed food. How many ingredients do they have? If they have more than five, they're a joke.
This book is more prescriptive. Do you see yourself continuing to write this way? Are you going to go back to the investigative journalism of your past?
This was a departure for me to write a prescriptive book. And my interest is satisfying my curiosity, telling stories, narrative, investigation. And I will be definitely going back to that.
And what can we expect to see from you next? Something in the New York Times Magazine?
I'm working on a piece right now for the Times Magazine about cooking on television. And how is it that we've turned cooking into a spectator sport in this country?
Mm. And a lot of people watch it and then don't cook for themselves.
A lot of people watch it and then complain they don't have time to cook.
Although that is an argument that we hear an awful lot from people who agree with you, that if you cook at home, you're going to change the way that food is produced because you're more likely to,
exactly
to
right.
buy things that are good for you.
Well, you know, look, you can't support local food unless you're cooking because local food is not processed. If you want to make one change and tune out all the advice, just start cooking. And, you know, we know that, in fact, as a predictor of a healthy diet, whether you cook or not is a better predictor than social class.
It also gets the family together.
Well, that's right. It has enormous social benefits as well.
Michael Pollan's latest book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, New York Times bestseller when it was in hardcover. Now I assume will be a paperback bestseller now that it has been released by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us again, Mike.
Oh, it's always great. Thank you, Leonard.